right. What is up, everybody? Welcome into the Denver Sports Podcast presented by Breckenridge Brewery, where you can get the Avalanche Amber, the unofficial beer of autumn in Colorado, but also unofficial beer of every day that feels like autumn.
Ooh.
The other day when it snowed, I drank an Avalanche Amber because it felt like fall.
What's a windy day beer from Breckenridge?
Ooh, that's true. What is a wind? I feel like this is an insult. That's the worst beer to drink. That's
no,
what
it's
get.
Just like, I don't want to go outside today, but I want to drink beer.
Nobody likes wind.
Oh, except windsurfers, I've learned.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, they
but
love
even
the
there,
wind.
Like, I feel like the ocean provides a natural amount of wind.
Yeah.
You don't need an extra windy day. I feel like that would be a disaster.
Well, I know this because there's no point in getting into windsurfing.
AJ almost waded into this. He's like, nope, I'm out. I'm staying away from it. Anyway, we're presented by Breckenridge Brewery. We got a fun show for you today. We're going to talk about Nikola Jokic and the pressure facing him. What appropriate amount of pressure and maybe some inappropriate amounts of pressure. How much pressure should he have and how can his legacy swing? We're also going to get an update on the Colorado Avalanche here, just a week and a half away from their playoffs beginning, and talk about what pressure they're feeling going in as they're into their title defense. And then later in the show, the best part of the show, we're going to look back at all the athletes that have had the most pressure going into a postseason, the biggest legacy swings based on an individual game or postseason run. To help me do that, though, the man that never stops podcasting, podcasts in his sleep. He podcasts when he wakes up. He podcasts for lunch. It's Ryan Konigsberg.
These mics are actually just grafted to my body.
Do you like how we all wore black today? Look at us.
If you ever wear black, you're going to match me.
Okay, well, there you go.
It's a pretty good chance it's true for me, too.
Well, there you go. I guess I just was fitting in. There he is, over on the edge, covering the Avalanche for us, AJ Haefeli.
What up, dog?
What up, dog? So let's talk about the Denver Nuggets here, who last night dropped a meaningless game ahead of tonight's equally as meaningless game.
Is it meaningless until they clinch?
We can talk about that very thing here in a second. Maybe it's okay. Not. I don't know if the Nuggets want to clinch. That's the thing. They're the one seed in the Western Conference, the third best record overall in the NBA currently. They're likely to finish one, although there is a chance that they just fumble this down the stretch. They punted on last night's game, effectively not playing Nikola Jokic. Punting on tonight's game, not playing any of their starters. Maybe Aaron Gordon for some reason, which I don't understand. But they've had a very good year.
Is
so good.
Maximum Mr. Nugget energy being the only starter to play.
I'm not leaving my boys out there.
Especially when he's probably the guy that most needs the rest at the moment. Yeah. But he's like, I'll do it. I got to play this meaningless game. But he'll do it. But here's the thing. Nikola Jokic currently on DraftKings Sportsbook is +110. I actually haven't looked this morning. Has it changed?
It's moved, yeah.
What is it?
Last I saw, he was +135, and Embiid had moved to -125.
All right. That was a little overcorrection after the ESPN straw poll. But nonetheless, Jokic is in the running for an MVP. I don't think he's going to win it this year.
I think he actively doesn't want to.
He doesn't want to, and I think people actively don't want to give it to him. But regardless, he's a two-time NBA MVP with a third one that could go to him. That he's at least in the running for, which means you're considered the best player in the NBA or in the conversation for best player. A lot of people push back on that. Jokic has only made it to the Western Conference Finals one time. He's never made it to an NBA Finals. He's 27 years old. That feels like there's a lot of pressure on him now to say, hey, if you're as good as you say you are, then you should at some point lead your team to a championship or at least a Finals or at the very least a competitive Western Conference Finals. So let me start with this, AJ. How much pressure when you read the clippings, you see the tweets, you see all this stuff, how much pressure do you think he is facing going into this? Before we get to what's appropriate.
I almost think it's not very much because he's a Denver Nugget and because of the way that franchise is viewed in the NBA, that it's almost not taken seriously.
Interesting.
Because he's the oddball, goofy MVP playing for a franchise that's never won anything that people don't generally care about. It almost feels like expectations for the franchise and expectations for the Jokic get split.
Is that true, though, of all franchises that have never won? Or is it Denver specific because it's mid-size?
I mean, I just think the Nuggets have one of those histories.
Okay.
Right? Where the Nuggets, they've been a professional franchise for 50 years.
Yeah.
And they've made a couple of conference finals along the way. And that's like their glory days.
I do think if it were another team that had never won before, it would be a similar thing.
Well, and I don't, because, I mean, we saw it with Giannis a few years ago before he won. With the Bucks, right?
Yeah, the Bucks are like Denver for sure.
And it was kind of similar where it's part of it, but it was more like, boy, it would be really great if he won one. Not like it was. I just don't feel like it was taking a ton away from his legacy. And now that he has one, it's not adding that much to it.
I'd have to say that there is, I think, more pressure than that. I think you're right about your point. But because of this whole MVP conversation where everyone is looking to detract from Jokic in any way that they can, he does face a lot of pressure from a narrative standpoint. Whereas if they don't get it done this year, and they don't have to win it, but if they don't make a deep run this year, then people are going to say, Jokic, all he is advanced analytics. He can't get it done in the playoffs. He's a regular season superstar, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I mean, wouldn't that be fair?
I do think there's a lot of that is fair in terms of if you're as great of a player, if you're a two-time MVP, odds are you're going to drag a team pretty far. You're going to win a series nobody thought you were supposed to, or one that you know, it took an amazing run for him to get to pass that one. And with Jokic, there's been some great series. I mean, he's had some incredible series so far. But to get there now where you're the one seed and things have kind of lined up and that there's no juggernaut in the NBA this year, I do feel like there is a lot of appropriateness to that pressure that, hey, something should happen this year.
At the same time...
Isn't this like the door being open that you want as a Nuggets franchise? You don't have a juggernaut to go through. You're not going through, you know, like the Melo Chauncey Nuggets in 09 had to go through Kobe's Lakers.
Right.
You know, like there was
LeBron's Lakers.
There was a final boss that you knew was standing in your way at the start of that run. And the question is can Jokic be the final boss?
Can I say this? Is there a chance we get to a Western Conference Finals that features the Warriors and it'll fill that, even though they haven't been that so far?
Yes.
Yeah. And isn't there a chance that...
1,000% yes.
And isn't there a chance that you'll get into a series with the Lakers? Maybe it's the first round where it's LeBron's healthy, AD's healthy. They're a 8 seed, but that's still like an obstacle. Like, hey, you still had to beat LeBron, which almost nobody ever does.
Well, I would say the counterpoint to that is what if they do make a deep run, a conference final run?
Yeah.
But their first round, you know, they beat the Pelicans.
Well,
and then the second round, they beat like a Paul George-less Clippers.
Right.
You know, and then there's little asterisk here and there where, again, because people are actively looking to take credit away from him, they're going to nitpick whatever. And then if they get to a conference final, even if the thing goes 7 games and they lose in 7 to say the Suns.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, you found your final boss, Jokic couldn't get it done.
Yeah, I feel like in that scenario you just laid out, that's almost the par where both sides of the argument, pro and con, are going to get to eat because there'll be enough ambiguity to say.
You'll be like, if that ball didn't tip off Aaron Gordon's fingertip in Game 7, he'd be playing for the finals right now.
Which will be both true and unsatisfying, but...
Yeah. You know. At the same time, though, I don't think the current... criticism of Jokic playoff success is fair.
No.
Because if that were to happen this year, people will say he's never gotten anything done in the playoffs and they'll use this large sample size. But every year has a story and people are letting go of that story. 2 years in a row, Jokic has dragged the team further than they were supposed to go. It's just not as far as people want. You know, it's not Elway dragging teams to the Super Bowls in the 80s. It's a little bit different than that. But like, people forget that they beat Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum, a healthy Blazers team with
Faku ended a Blazers
and Shaq
era.
Harrison. Yeah.
They ended that era.
They ended a Utah era, too. It lingered. It festered. It had an open wound for like an extra year.
Yeah, I mean, it's like getting shot in the stomach. It was a slow death.
They bled out,
But that was it. The shot that did it.
I think someone said if you bet $100 on every Jokic playoff series... since he started, you'd be at like $3,000.
Wow.
So like, and then it was like,
that's a great stat.
You'd be down like $1,500 if you
find out
Embiid.
What this is for me, because that's great. I need that one in my life.
I would also say that when you're talking about using Jokic's playoff history as it is today, it's very, very similar to what the Avs did last year, where everybody was like, oh, they choke, they can't get out of the second round.
Right.
And when you actually went back in time and you looked at it, and it was like they were an 8th seed,
right?
Who had no business.
First year, you got to go through.
Yeah, the first year, they were the 8th seed that nobody picked to beat Calgary.
Right.
They smoked Calgary. They get into a 7-game series with San Jose. The second year, Michael Hutchinson is their netminder and is 5 minutes from bringing them back from a 3-1 series deficit
right.
in a game seven. And then the 1 year where you can be like, yes, they fell apart.
Right, right.
Against Vegas, who also, by the way, tied them for the President's Trophy that year. So it was like no slouch there.
Right.
But using that history against the Avs the last couple of years has been really annoying. Because when you look at it, it was like, come on with some of this. And it's the same thing with Jokic where you're like, Jamal gets hurt. And then obviously all the injury issues that they had last year. It was what did you want him to do?
Right. Here's the thing.
We watched Steph Curry have like an iconic moment in a play-in game.
Right, right, right.
And it was Steph Curry.
Yeah.
Nobody minded that. Yeah.
But here's the thing about it. I think what I don't like is people try to go back and rewrite the history on Jokic or diminish it. Like what happened in the past wasn't impressive because it was the bubble or because they got swept by the Suns or whatever. When it's like, no, what happened in the past was awesome and very impressive and it required great games where he was at his best when his back is against the wall. Jokic, even though he's only been in the playoffs 4 years, has been in elimination games like 14 times. Like he's faced a lot of elimination and he's always been at his absolute apex during those games. So I hate the rewriting history. But what's fair is the future stakes. To me, that part is fair. Just don't go backwards to rewrite. You can project forwards and say, do you have the number?
Yes. If you bet $1,000 on every Jokic playoff series, you'd be up $6,321. The other side of it is if you bet $1,000 on every Embiid playoff series, you'd be down $3,900.
I feel like that's a meaningful thing here.
That is.
Well, and let's be real here. Embiid's played with other guys that you would consider a superstar. Or before he completely fell apart, Ben Simmons.
Yeah.
Right, right, right.
And Jimmy Butler.
Jimmy Butler.
He has always had, like, where's the other all-star? His best sidekick for Jokic. Like, his best sidekick is Jamal Murray, who is a good player.
Right. Nobody's taking him over James Harden, though. But here's the bigger thing.
The Nuggets have been dogs in 4 out of 8 playoff series that Jokic has played in.
It's wild. That's wild. Here's the thing, the other piece of that, though, because when I always compare the Embiid Jokic part, because a lot of it comes down to defense. Pick and roll is the thing that in the NBA, spread pick and roll is the hardest thing for a big, any big, no matter how good you are. Jokic's worse than most, but all bigs are below the threshold. This is my belief. There's players like Bam Adebayo, but they're not true bigs. They're 6'9". They're actually more power forwards traditionally. But my point is, Jokic has gone up against Steph Curry, Damian Lillard twice, Donovan Mitchell, Devin Booker, Chris Paul. That's been the playoff seasons. That's probably the 5 best pick and roll pull up 3-point shooters, which is the single most difficult thing to guard. You go and look at Philadelphia in the Embiid era, the toughest one he's had to guard, I think, is Trae Young, who they lost to, by the way, and Bradley Beal and Spencer Dinwiddie. I think that's the 3 best pick and roll. Those guys are okay. Trae Young is good.
Yeah.
But that is not Steph Curry, Damian Lillard, Devin Booker, Chris Paul. Like it's a different repertoire.
Steph and Dame are probably 2 of the best of all time at that.
At all time. And I mean, look, Booker and Chris Paul are also pretty freaking good at that specific skill. Nonetheless, I don't want to make this the Embiid thing. I want to just talk about pressure. And here's what's crazy about the pressure on Jokic specifically. One, it doesn't just validate him. It validates the Nuggets' plans. And when Jamal Murray went down, this playoffs counts for 3. It doesn't count for 1. It counts for the previous 3 years. Whereas if Denver is to like go to the Western Conference Finals this year, you can make a realistic case and say, man, how many Western Conference Finals would the team have gone to if they would have had Murray? Right. Whereas if they would have lost in the first round, it'd be a hard thing to say, man, yeah, but last year or 2 years ago, they were on pace to go to the Western Conference Finals. Like it almost swings 3 years all in 1.
That's a great point.
It does, yeah.
It's like when you're like betting on golf and you keep tying holes and you're just like, keep putting it into the pot.
Right.
And so 2 years have been put into the pot for this one.
It's 100% it. And then lastly, for the Jokic specifically, he's a 2-time MVP. He's almost averaging a triple-double. It's gonna suck that we're going to have to always say almost averaged a triple-double.
Yeah, he needs like
16. He needs like a game with 16 assists.
Well, if he did that, then he would be averaging it and then he would just need 10. I think now that he's missed 2, he's going to need like 12 a game to finish.
I'm not holding my breath. I have a feeling that this, and I think Jokic almost wants to do this because of the stat batting content. There'd just be something like, how many guys would have been within 6 assists and gunned for it? Not me. I didn't care.
Right.
And he won't say this, but that'll be the idea. But here's the thing. It doesn't matter. Statistically, one of the best players ever. Advanced stats, the best player ever. Probably a little inflated, but whatever. You win a championship, all of a sudden it's like, well, let's put his resume up against these all-time greats. How many players have two MVPs and a championship? That list is really small. So is he...
he'd probably have a finals MVP. Finals MVP.
Then a finals MVP. Yeah,
if they were, if they were to get to that point, like...
Yeah. Triple-double average. Like, you start to put the accolades up and you'll be like, wow, this guy has a better resume. Whether you want to say he's better, it has a better resume than a lot of Hall of Fame, like top-tier Hall of Fame players. Whereas if you lose...
Like, wouldn't that move him past a guy like Charles Barkley, like, immediately?
Again, yes. I don't want to put the cart before the horse here and say it, but I'm saying those are the type of conversations that you can have and not feel crazy, because you'll have the hardware to match up with all the accolades and statistics. On the other end, if you lose in a first round or a second round even, and it's not competitive, it's one you walk away going, they lost, but they were not as good as the top teams of this year. It almost swings the other way to where it diminishes some of the accolades in some way. I don't think it should, but I do think you'll have a harder time arguing things when you say, well, those two MVPs, but it didn't really get close to winning a title, you know, at this or that. So that's why I say the pressure is so high, because the narrative swing. I don't know if he feels it. I'm just saying that narrative swing is about as big as I've seen from a player outside of LeBron in the NBA, outside of LeBron James in 2011, 2012.
Yeah. I also think the reason why I get what you're saying, but why I'm kind of like, I just don't know that it matters, is because I don't think he cares about
he
it.
He does.
Enough.
I don't. Well,
and when you talk about like the pressure, like it's usually like you look at Nathan MacKinnon last year. He felt it.
Right.
He felt it every day. He walked with it. It almost looked like you could just see it walking around. It was like his shadow. Right. Like it went with him everywhere. And I don't know that Jokic is wired in that. Like, I think Jokic wants to win because he wants to win, and that's just like it's like the thing he's there to do. I'm there to play great basketball. I'm there to win. I'm there to do whatever. I wonder about the way that he feels that pressure and the way that he carries it with him, and it's almost like he's just not worried about all this other stuff as much. He doesn't care about his legacy. He doesn't care. You know, he doesn't care about this. He cares about winning.
I think he does care about winning,
and that's well, and that's it. He's not worried about what Nick Wright has to say on whatever show he's on.
Yeah, but here's where I disagree with you, because I'm with you on the legacy part, and I do think that adds an extra burden to players. So he is short of that. But I do think he feels the responsibility to the team. He's the one that gets all the credit for all the big things. He gets the big contract. He gets all this stuff he wants and doesn't want. But he also, I think, really genuinely feels a responsibility. And when we had Vlacko on the show, he talked about it. Like, Yoke's drowning in stress because of how much is, like, projected onto him. The other thing about Yoke, where it's unique, we exist in an era now where I think athletes get things projected onto them politically and this or that. And Jokic is an unaccepting but forced symbol of things he has no association with, or at least that he doesn't want. He's a symbol of analytics. He doesn't care about analytics, but he's a symbol. For him to lose would be a knock on
the analytics
for advanced stats. If he were to lose, he's a symbol of European players. He didn't ask for that. He doesn't identify with Germans and Italians. He's a Serbian guy. But he is representative of all European players, representative of white players. Mm-hmm. He's representative of Denver in a lot of ways. He's representative of nice guys. He's representative of passing players as opposed to scoring players. So I say that, and I think...
Skill guys over athleticism guys.
All of that stuff is a thing that he is not wanting, but is inevitably taking on, and I just think he feels it. That's why I think there's a special amount of pressure on him.
Yeah. I mean, I've noticed it this year more than any other year that he hears things.
Yeah.
And it's kind of odd, like, cause I've always believed like Jokic would never hear what Kendrick Perkins has to say.
And he mentioned it this year.
He admitted that he heard what Kendrick Perkins had to say.
I think he regrets that, by the way. That shows you how much it got to him though, that he like, you know, when something bothers you, you don't say anything. All of a sudden, it slips out, and it's like, oh. Mm-hmm. I feel like that was Yoke, where it was like, you're commenting on an ESPN story? I've never seen this before. And then he immediately was like, what did I slip that slip out?
What bums me out is I think that really affected him, especially the race one, because he was then aligned on a side of a thing that he doesn't want to be on, you know, and we saw all the weird shit that happened after that. And I think that actually had an impact on him, and I hope that, you know, that goes away and he can kind of shake that. But I think because of that, I think he does feel the pressure. And I think that while he's not worried about his legacy, I think he does want to prove people wrong. I think that inherently as humans, we want to prove people wrong that don't believe in us you know, maybe more than any other like desire.
Oh, I have so much pressure on me. I think I have more pressure than Jokic at the moment. Like my reputation is on the line here.
That's how I felt last year.
No, it's true, but like you just want to prove people wrong. And so I think that he has a lot of pressure. I think that he feels it. And I think that we are going to see a playoff Joker like we've never seen before.
Yeah.
Because every year he gets better in the regular season, and then he takes it up to another level in the playoffs. And then he was better last year in the regular season, and then he got even better in the playoffs. Obviously, they had no shot. This year, he's taken his game to a new level. And the more I watch it, the more I'm like, we have not even had a glimpse of playoff Joker, and he is averaging a triple-double. Like, I think there's a decent chance he averages a 30-point triple-double in the playoffs.
I agree with this take. I think we're in for Jokic laying waste to the postseason.
There are little
signs. I
think
it's going to be like an all-time heater where you're like, say something. Like, whatever the team does, whatever happens, right? It's going to be like, there's no doubt that he did what he could.
It's honestly what's on his shoulders. I am of the opinion that Jokic is that player. So for him not to do it, like, there would be a disconnect there. I think he's that talented enough, and I do think he's motivated enough. And I've also, you know what? We're only 10 days away. Playoffs start in less than like 17 days, so like a week after that. So we'll find out here very quickly. But I tend to agree that this is Jokic has an anger in him that he hasn't had lately because of these things have just built up. And he's like, what are we talking about? And you mentioned the race thing. I actually think the stat padding was a bigger deal to him.
Oh,
if you remember, in the bubble was during the pandemic and during a lot of the riots and a lot of the police brutality protests and different things. And he was asked a lot about it. And you know, he's like, guys, I'm European. I don't have the American history to me, which is fair, right? He's like, we have our own politics and histories and different things to us over in Serbia. And he mostly abstained from that, and I understand why. But stat padding, I think if you were to ask Jokic, what's the thing with your basketball that you're most proud of, it'd be that I play the right way. I play a team game. I have this honestness about me for how I approach. And I think the stat padding
It
calls that into question. The thing that he's most core value is, and I think that's why that one specifically probably pissed him off.
I mean, there's no coincidence that his assist numbers have gone down since that came out.
Maybe. I mean, people say that. They went on that losing streak. Jokic had 2 30-point triple-doubles. He was still balling.
Yes.
The
but
team
he's,
had fallen off.
He was.
He was playing terrible defense.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I just think that he's like, you know, late in the game, he's not like seeking out a backdoor cut as much.
Now you're calling him into question.
No, I'm not calling. I'm just saying, AJ. Like, he loves passing the ball.
Yeah.
He said it before, like an assist makes two people happy, makes me. Uh-oh. And so like, I think late in games, he just loves to get Aaron Gordon a reverse dunk and things like that. And ever since that happened, I haven't seen him do that.
Yeah. All right, let's take a break. On the other side, we'll find out what pressure there is for a team after they win a title and then have a somewhat underwhelming regular season. We'll get to all of that. I'm, of course, talking about the Avs. But first, RK, what can you tell me about Illegal Pete's?
Oh, man, Illegal Pete's. So it's funny about Illegal Pete's is we've been having a lot of guests on the Buff Show lately. And I used to ask, like, oh, are you an Illegal Pete's guy? And the answer was always yes. So I just stopped asking that. Now, really? Whenever we have a guest, I just say, what's your order at Illegal Pete's? Because everyone has their order at Illegal Pete's. And for me, currently, it's the reverse nachos. D-Line actually put me onto the reverse nachos.
This is gaming the system.
It is. And I actually got called out by it once by a person working at Illegal Pete's.
Tell him, hey, man, I'm ordering off the menu.
Exactly. And he was like, no, I'm not hating on it. I'm just saying this is gaming the system.
Yes,
and
it is.
You get a giant burrito bowl with like double queso.
That's all it is. For free, basically.
Yeah, for the cost of nachos. So get over to Illegal Pete's. Check them out. They also have a whole new line of margaritas, which absolutely slap.
Also, Shady Rays.
Shady Rays. Ooh, I haven't done this one in a minute. It's heating up, right?
It is heating up.
It's almost shade season. You actually need your shades extra today.
It's shade season.
Oh,
already.
It is?
Yeah, it is shade season.
Interesting.
I'm telling you, driving in the other day, I was dying.
Okay.
So sunny out.
Well, you especially need your Shady Rays today because not only do they protect you from the sun, but they protect you from the particles of dust that are just whipping around Denver today.
What did we say? We have a haboob today?
Ooh.
Have you heard that term?
A haboob?
No. The haboob. Look it up. You can pull this up on, yeah, I'm telling you, a haboob is like a
windstorm.
It's like a slow dust where the dust comes in.
Okay, yes. We have
Google a haboob and pull it up on the screen here. I'm teaching the people some terms today.
Well, if you're dealing with a haboob, make sure you get your shady rays because they'll protect your eyes not only from dangerous dust particles, but also from dangerous UV rays. They're polarized. You can get a great deal on them when you use the code DNVR. Over at Shady Rays. We all have them here. We all love them.
It's an unbelievable deal, by the way. 50% off. That's a great one. A 2-for-1. What do you got over there? Do you have it? Look at this. Pull up a fixture. Look at that. You guys. Oh,
so that's like a legitimate dust storm.
It's like a wall of dust. And when I say wall, it goes up to the clouds. You guys have never seen one of these? A haboob?
I have seen this
in Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it's like.
Really big deal in that movie.
I think they're big in Arizona.
Yeah, that seems terrible. Also needs a scarier name than haboob.
Haboob is the weakest sounding name. Yeah. Oh no, run from the haboob.
They should just call it a Fury Road.
Yeah, it should be like a doom cloud.
Yeah,
doom cloud. That sounds real. Look at how big it is. It engulfs a whole city. That is what it felt like today, though. It did feel that way.
Yeah. Dude, you could hear it on our Broncos podcast. Like, people are like, what is going on back there? It's just the wind.
Yeah, it really was. All right, AJ.
What up?
You guys are so relaxed. You guys are so relaxed because every time I turn on, here's how the season has gone. I'll check in maybe every 2 weeks. Somebody will be around and be like, hey man, Avs, are we worried? And they're like, nah, they just got to win on Saturday. Saturday comes around 7-0, they lose. Like, you guys worried? Nah. Wait a second. So I'm guessing the pressure you would say is quite low on the Avs right now.
It's hard to hold a team to a certain standard when that team hasn't played any games together. You know, like the team that I've said this a few times, but the team that the Kroenkes paid for this year has played 0 minutes together. You know, they haven't had their captain for one game all year. As of whenever they clinch their postseason spot, they will be one of like something like 8 teams in the last 20 years to have 400 man games lost and make the postseason.
Wow.
So it really drives home the challenges that they've faced, but it also should drive home. it should also really drive home like how special the talent is at the top of the Avalanche roster.
That they're just that good.
That you have 400 man games lost, and you look at the top leaders in scoring, and Mikko Rantanen could be on his way to a 50 goal season. Nathan MacKinnon is 5 points shy of 100. Kale McCarr. Is going to like backdoor his way into Norris votes at the very end of the year. And it's just like, oh yeah, by the way, they just have 3 of the 15 best players on their roster. And as much as the NHL is a, you need these guys to be successful, like, you know, and you need depth to get you to a certain area. You need all this help, you know, 18 skaters and blah, 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 blah. If you've got elite talent, you just have a big advantage. And that's where the Avs have been this year.
What do you see pressure-wise from them as a non-Avs guy?
You know, what's funny is they really felt the pressure last year. I mean, as much as I think you can and still succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was in everything that they did. Every practice, every skate, every morning, everything. Every presser, every inch of that roster felt that pressure.
Nathan MacKinnon said that before Game 5 at home in the Stanley Cup. Guys were throwing up because it was so intense and they felt like they were so close. And so when you've felt the pressure at the highest of high levels and overcome it, I almost worry that they have too little pressure on
them. Wow.
Because I just don't think...
I like that.
Like, you can't pressure them anymore. They can't feel scared. And I think it could end up becoming a weapon for them in the playoffs. But I almost... You know, Von Miller, the year after the Broncos won the Super Bowl, said it's impossible to not get to the mountaintop and take a breath of fresh air. And he essentially was saying, like, I didn't work as hard this offseason, or I didn't, like, it's just impossible. You know, I didn't have the same feeling in me of I have to get there. So I don't think you can blame the Avs for not feeling the pressure. I'm just curious. It's going to be, I think, on a dime. Whether or not that becomes a weapon for them to use in the postseason is like, you feel the pressure, we don't, we're champions. Or if it's just like they don't have something that's forcing them to, you know, add that extra 10% at the end of that shift. Like, you know, we saw it in Game 6. The third period was like one of the most incredible displays of hockey I've ever seen, because it was the entire team emptying the tank to zero. And right. It was just like, we are giving everything we have for 20 minutes to make sure we win this cup.
It's an all-time underrated goaltending performance from Vasilevskiy to keep that a 2-1 hockey game.
100%. And an all-time...
It should have finished 5-1.
Easy goaltending performance.
That the on Avs, the net.
The what the Avs did in the third period of that game, like every conventional, like you sit back, you play smart, you do it. And the Avs were like, no, we are going to attack you until we have nothing left, until we have to defend at the very end. And they 20 minute period, and they spent 17 of those minutes just cramming the puck down Tampa Bay's throat.
All time performance by Vasilevskiy. All-time easy third period with a lead to win the Stanley Cup performance for Darcy Kemper.
I don't know,
he had
man.
To make two saves.
And they were big ones.
They were huge. He made them.
You are talking Nikita Kucherov is, what, third in the NHL in scoring this year? And he stops him on a one-timer coming across the crease. Like, that was it right there. When they made that win. When they made that stop, it was like, oh, that was their chance. Like,
but when you envision a third period to clinch the Stanley Cup, you envision just bombs at the goalkeeper.
Yeah, you envision 20 minutes of what the Avs did in San Jose in game seven, where it was just shots were like 19-1 at the end of that game, at the end of that period, because it was just an all-out assault of desperation to try and tie the game. And then, you know, it just didn't work out for either one of those teams that were trying to come back. But the Avs, what they did is they put them down. I mean, you can't more thoroughly put down a defending champ than what they did.
But and all this is to say, do they have that level in them? Do they have, like, you know, 110% is overused in sports.
Sure.
Like, can't do without the pressure of, you know, we have to win this to solidify this, you know, this run that we've put together. Do they have the let's crank it up to 110% for one period because we have to win this hockey game for our legacies?
Do they have that?
Yeah.
Why do you think so?
Because they haven't had it all season. Because they haven't really felt in the two moments this season that team had to take a good hard look in the mirror and say, what are we really made of? Are we for real about this thing or not? They've walked out the next day and ripped off winning streaks. So anytime that this team has actually been down on the mat and had to actually get up and do it, they have responded the way that a champion responds. And for me, I'm just like, look, everybody that lives in Edmonton should be over the moon about what Connor McDavid has done this year. He's the best player in the world, and that's all good and well. But the second the postseason starts, if you're not backing Nathan MacKinnon, you're not backing the right guy.
Really?
I love
Nathan,
it.
I think Nathan MacKinnon's about to do something absolutely epic. Whatever Jokic is about to do in the postseason, MacKinnon's going to do the hockey version of.
Really?
I think he's been... This is the best that I've ever seen Nathan MacKinnon play in his entire career. And we're going on like 40 games of it. So, and he's had some downs. You know, he has a couple of games here and there. But he responds with the kind of fury that you just can't. It's a thing that you just have to have inside of you, that kind of hunger, and it's this never ending will to win and climb the mountain again. And I think that just because the Avs have faced the issues that they've had, they get even a little bit healthy going into the postseason. Whoever gets them in round one is going to get turned inside out, because I think that they are going to find a switch. They're going to find that level, and they're going to have the kind of goaltending they didn't have last year. And they're going to need it because they're not as good as last year's team. But I think they're going to be just as hungry because they've spent all year having people tell them, you know, oh, you're not as good as this. You're not as good as that. You're not last year's team. You're not this and you're not that. And then at the end of the day, those guys can look in the mirror and say, you know what we are? Is we are champions, and all these other guys are not.
But perhaps they're also adrenaline junkies, what you're talking about. This idea that the stakes aren't very high in the regular season when you've been to a postseason. Yeah. And you're saying they've played their best when they're backed against the wall.
Yeah.
Well, that's an adrenaline junkie.
Yeah.
Nathan MacKinnon said the time they felt the most comfortable in the playoffs last year was when they were down one goal on the road. That's like when they felt they played their best hockey.
Right.
They just like settled in and they're like, watch this.
Yeah.
If you watch them after they get down in the clinching game after Stamkos scores 90 seconds into game six, Tampa Bay goes all out for about 5 minutes. And when they don't get that second goal, the next 55 minutes of that is the Avalanche just laying waste to them.
So there's the pressure that I think decreases once you've won a title, but the confidence that I think increases once you've won a title. Do you feel they're a more confident team?
Yeah, I do, because now there's none of the nagging self-doubt. Right. There's no, you know, Nathan McKinnon's not going to be like, am I a one-hit wonder? He's going to be like, Sid has three.
Right.
And that's all he's going to care about.
This is my thing with Yoke. If they get a title, he's going to shoot four times as many Sombor shuffles.
Mm.
That's a shot you kind of have to be like, I don't give a F. I'm shooting this one. And I just think he'll have a little bit more. The pass, the over-the-head stuff, I just think we'll get about 30 more of those a year. Because it's just like, what do I get?
I want to see final form Jokic so badly.
Well, when you talk, you know, we've talked about iron sharpens iron and the way that you go through things. I think that what built the Avs into this emotional, you know, just like this powder keg that's waiting to just erase teams in the postseason is that they lost and they remember how much it sucked to lose.
Right.
And I think this year has kind of been a good reminder to them how hard this is.
Right.
And they keep it in, it's been in the back of their mind all year. They've had to fight for every single inch of it. That I think that when they get into the postseason, it's going to be a breath of fresh air where they're like, this is a fresh start. We're not chasing anything. We're chasing our own history. And I think that when they take an honest look at it, they say, we're better than all of these teams. And if they get Gabe Landeskog back, and I think they're going to at some point.
Let's go.
But I think if they get Gabe Landeskog back, they're going to find a different level. Like, Gabe Landeskog's going to go out and he's going to fight somebody 16 seconds in his first shift. He's going to eat that guy's heart on the ice, and it's going to be game on for the rest of the NHL.
Wow.
I'm hyped, baby. Let's go.
No, I just sat next to McChesney for an hour. AJ's cooking over here. I'm like, geez, I need to go.
When do playoffs start for the Avs?
The last regular season game is 2 weeks from today, and then it will start 3 days after that.
Okay.
Basically, April 17th.
Okay.
Right in that area.
There we go. We're coming up on it, man.
What's the most likely matchup right now?
I couldn't.
It's too impossible.
Yeah.
Too close.
Too impossible.
Yeah, the six teams are all still vying for positioning. So.
All right. RK, tell me a little bit about Breckenridge Brewery.
The best. I mean, straight up the best beers that you can get. We absolutely love them here. We have for years. And one of the best things about Breckenridge Brewery is they have supported us for so long. You know, we've kind of become synonymous, and I think it's a really cool thing. Got the Avalanche Ales in front of us here. You got the Mile High City Golden Ale. There's so many great beers from Breckenridge Brewery.
What's the holiday one that's like 12%? No, not Holiday Ale. What's the other one? That's like a porter, but it's like 12% because I had one day.
Buddy Pass?
Buddy Pass.
Buddy Pass, it's different.
You know how many Buddy Passes you need to be wasted? Like three?
Yes.
I had one before doing a show, and I was like, am I drunk right now?
I know. I called it the Buddy Pass because you're drinking for two.
It is, exactly.
You and a buddy.
It's perfect.
So check out our friends over at Breckenridge Brewery. Use the Breck Brew Locator. No matter where you are in America, you can go to BreckenridgeBrewery.com/beer locator to find out where the nearest Breck Brews are to you.
What do
you
want? Internationally beloved Breck Brew.
Yes.
Every time I go up to Canada, I take beer with me.
That's really awesome.
And just distribute it to people.
That's hilarious.
When we went to London, people were like, can you please bring cases of Breck Brew?
Yes, yeah.
I love that stuff.
My brother-in-law was like, you just bring me a keg of this stuff. I'll pay for customs. Bring me a keg of it. And I was like, I'm not doing that. But
that's an inefficient way to get that beer up there.
I did bring him
a keg on a commercial airline.
I drive, man.
Oh, that's right. You drive. What do you tell me about Circle K? You ever done this one?
Nope.
All right, guys. We're excited to be partnering with our friends at Cervical K. It's because they're new. That's why I was like, I pulled it up because I was like, I don't know.
Definitely
about
this
not
one. On Broncos, bets, or buffs.
Here's the thing about Circle K. I make coffee in the morning, it's never good. So instead, now I go down to Circle K because gas station coffee.
You make bad coffee every day?
Well, I'm saying I actually stopped, but this is why I always brew it. I'm always like, it's terrible. But you go, it's like 99 cents. You get the little coffee. Then I come back home just for that one reason. They got all that great stuff. And then you know what else they have? They have like an enormous selection of different snacks and different things. Best road trip snack? What are you going for?
Best road trip snack for me is beef jerky.
Beef jerky?
Yep.
I'm a Gardetto's on a road trip guy.
What are Gardetto's?
It's like, you know, the things that have the little rye chips in there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you know that they make a special where it's just the rye chip stuff.
I know. I've crushed a couple bags.
Okay.
That's how I am, too. I like the Chex Mix, though. The Chex Mix ones. But I'll have to check out Gardetto's. Great coffee. Lots of locations all over Denver, and we appreciate them becoming a sponsor for us. So if you guys are looking to get a little energy drink, a little coffee, a little snack or something like that, check out Circle K. All right. Guys, the last segment here of the Denver Sports Podcast, I want to talk about the players and the moments where they faced the most pressure. In Denver sports history, maybe they won, maybe they lost, but where areas where you could say, man, was that a pressured-filled game for that guy?
I don't think anything can top the Broncos and John Elway specifically heading into the 1997 season. Like, they were so good in 96, or I guess it would be the 96-97 season. They were so good in 95-96, they get upset by the Jags in kind of embarrassing fashion.
Not kind of.
Yeah.
In not embarrassing kind fashion. Of. You guys, people have to understand this that are not, you know, my age or whatever that went through this. Like, Elway was my, I'm just, well, what I'm saying is, Elway was my first athlete by a long shot. The second athlete was so far below. It was Elway. And he just lost. Like, yeah. Played great, had big moments, but always lost. And so there was this feeling of inevitability. And 96, honestly, was the year I most believed they were going to win. And they lost the first game. And it just felt to me like they're never going to win.
Yep.
They're just never going to.
They had a very Chargers-esque feel about them.
Yeah.
What would become a Chargers-esque feel?
Right.
Because, like, Michael Dean Perry getting called for too many men on the field. Because he's got 1 foot still on the field as he's walking off.
Yeah,
just cursed. So that
they could punt and they could, you know, give them the first down and then turns into points. And, oh, my God, dude. It was Michael Dean Perry has haunted my nightmares my entire life because of that game.
Yeah.
And it was, by the way, the Jaguars.
Yeah.
I know.
Natron Means.
You know what I mean? McCardle. Like, it wasn't even like you got bested by Joe Montana or something. Like, what can you do? You know, it was
the Jags. Damn
Jaguars.
Yeah. Mark and then their lefty quarterback. So, yeah, I mean, going into that next season, the Broncos probably had the most pressure anyone's had on them in Denver sports history, in my opinion.
You think so? You don't think that when the Avs were down 3-2 in 2001 with Ray Bourque, knowing he was retiring at the end of that year, going into New Jersey to the defending champ's house and winning game six the way that they did?
They probably
down 3-2 in that series, and Patrick Waugh wins them game six the way that he does.
What I will say,
plays one of the all-time great Stanley Cup final games.
What I will say about that, and I think it's a good argument, and this is a feather in the cap of the Avs, the Avs actually increased the pressure on the Broncos going into 96-97.
What a take. I love it.
They walked in and won the championship. Yeah. Like, the Broncos were everyone was living and dying with the Broncos and dying and dying and dying. And then the Avs walk in, win a championship. They're the new big man on campus. And, like, I legitimately think that put an extra thorn in Elway's side to be like, hell no, this is my town.
He's been at this for 15 years.
I have to get this done. I'm winning a championship this season.
Yeah.
And then Terrell Davis did it for him.
Man, I can't believe this. AJ being a hater over here. Oh, it was awesome.
Not really. No, he was.
I mean, you're right that, of course, that he was. Was that his MVP year? Was it that season or the next one?
It was the next year.
The next year
was his MVP season. But he was unbelievable, of course. But Elway was also unbelievable.
Yeah, but you also look at the big difference was that Elway had help.
Right.
And for the first time.
It's so true.
And maybe for the first time, he needed it. Like, he, like, needed it. He could have used it all those other years. Would it have made a difference when you were going up against Jerry Rice and Joe Montana, all those guys? Right. I don't know.
Right.
Maybe against Phil Simms.
I love Steve Atwater tells a story about when they played. It was his rookie season. They played against the Niners in the Super Bowl. And he was like, man, we were watching film all week. I felt so confident. First play, deep post, Montana to Rice, cooked. And I was just like, shit. We are not ready.
We're not ready for this. Let's go then to 2001. So the difference for that one for me a little bit is just that Elway was so ingrained.
And they didn't have a championship yet.
And they didn't have a championship and it was so ingrained. You're right that for Bourque, that was the swan song. And so maybe there was pressure on him because I imagine you feel like, man, is this my last game of my career and it's going to be a goddamn loss at the doorstep? So I imagine he felt it, and I do think there was individual stakes within the moment of 3-2, but was there more broader than that?
I think that a really underrated amount of pressure was on Joe Sakic that year, because this is a
Year before.
This is a famous story about Avs history, but in 2000, when they lost for the second straight year in Game 7 in Dallas, Joe Sakic had the worst postseason of his career. And just, he just wasn't very good.
Right.
And we think of Joe Sakic as a demigod, right?
Right.
He was.
And clutch.
He was just unbelievable. Yeah, he has the NHL record for playoff overtime goals. So, yes, like he does also have that. And then you go back and you look at him in that 2000 year, you look at the numbers, you remember how he played during that run. He just wasn't very good. And on the team plane, on the flight back to Denver after their season had ended, Patrick Waugh, Adam Foote, and Ray Bourque walked with the backup plane, talked to Sakic and say, you know, Ray will come back for one more year, but you need to lead us. Where were you? You need to be better. You need to be everything that you need to be as Joe Sakic needs to come back next year. Ray is coming back. You need to figure this out. And if you go and you look, that Avs team, wire to wire, just won a President's wagon. Trophy. They were obsessed with home ice. Because they lost consecutive game sevens on the road.
Right.
They wanted home ice. They needed it. They got it. And Joe Sakic, if you go and rewatch the cup final, Peter Forsberg gets hurt. He's not in that series. Joe Sakic is unbelievable in that cup final. He dominates a Devils defense that has Scott Stevens and Scott Niedermeyer on it. Two guys who are in the Hall of Fame. It was a clash of all the Titans at all the positions, and Joe Sakic had the best series, arguably among all those guys, except for maybe Patrick Waugh.
What a unique brand of pressure!
Yeah,
pressure applied to you by your own teammates.
Yeah,
it's kind of unheard of.
Two of those three guys, you could make arguments for being the best at their position,
right?
Ever in Ray Bourque and Patrick Waugh, and then you know Adam Foote. His number is in the rafters at Ball Arena.
Yeah. For the Nuggets, I don't know if there's other ones. I mean, you could look at the Melo era was so weird because they lost every year in blowout fashion. Yep. They made it to game five twice. Otherwise, they just kept getting swept and just kept losing. And so by the time 2009 came along, I think some people would say was there pressure there, but I don't know if there necessarily was more pressure. They were just a better team. And then, of course, they went into six games in the Western Conference Finals. But I don't think there was more pressure on anybody in that year. It didn't feel like the end of an era. It turned out to be because the next year George Karl got cancer, and the year after that, Melo's traded. So it actually was the last year, but it didn't feel like it at the time.
Happy ending to that story.
What's that?
Yeah.
So that was a real happy ending to that story.
That's the Nuggets history, unfortunately. I would say
there's probably pressure on George Karl specifically.
Kind of yes and no, though. Like George Karl he became known as a guy that couldn't get out of the first round. Like he's just a regular season coach. They did have that run. So I don't remember there ever being a year where it's like he has to do it this year. The way with Jokic, where it just kind of feels like things swing now. Will Jokic have more chances to redeem himself? Yes, but things will swing so hard for him. And I'll go back. The guy that I think, or the example of a player that I think had a lot of pressure. I don't know if Jokic was feeling this in the bubble or not, but game four of the bubble first round, when the Nuggets were down 2-1 and Rudy Gobert had absolutely dominated Jokic in game three, blocked his shot, screamed in his, like, it was so embarrassing. That game four, and then obviously throughout the rest of this, to me, carried an enormous amount of pressure because if Denver loses that series in five games, this team looks completely different.
Yeah,
there's probably a different coach, there's different co-stars, everything. And the way that both he and Murray stepped up the rest of that series was really impressive. Even though they lost game four, they both settled themselves and then went on to come back. But I just remember thinking in that game, I was like, Jokic loses this one, man. There's no MVPs. We didn't know he was coming anyway, but there would have been no MVPs. And at the uphill climb he would have had to make up for that one series would have been so big.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever seen you vote Eric Harrison more down bad than you were after that game four.
It's the low. It's easily the low.
I was like, Jesus, I got to get out of here.
The stakes this year are higher, so they could swing both higher and lower than that. But that was like the ultimate. I can't believe I believed in a guy and they're going to lose to the goddamn Jazz in five games. I just, it was so unfathomable that that almost, but did not happen. Any other Avs ones?
What's crazy is right at that low, pretty much gave the best upswing.
That's sports.
In Nuggets history.
That's sports. You can't have the positive charge without the negative charge. Yep. So however happy you will be should your team win is equally proportionate to how painful it will be if your team loses. That's how I feel with Denver. Like, the swing between this could be the greatest year of my life as a sports fan versus this could be the worst year of my life as a sports fan. They're just proportionate, man.
I love that about sports.
I do too.
And it's why I try to make myself as emotionally vulnerable as possible when exactly it comes to sports, because I'm like, I want the highs to be high and the lows to be low. Like, that's what makes me feel alive.
Is there any other Avs ones we can think of?
I mean, last year's team, you're coming off of losing in the second round for the third straight year, but you were the President's Trophy winner. You know, you have this generation. You've got Landeskog. You've got Rantanen and MacKinnon and Makar. Can you do something with it? You've got a head coach. Can he validate that he's got a history of winning at all the other levels? But, yeah, exactly.
I mean, there's an alternate universe where he is the Ken doll.
Yeah.
Didn't happen. It's not this universe.
There's also an alternate universe where Kisla knows what he's talking about.
All right. We'll just go there.
So, yeah. Sorry. You don't ever get to come back from that.
That's true. You say it. You just have to own that you were wrong.
You get to wear that for the rest of your career, that you were that guy.
Right. Is there a Broncos one you can think of? Another Broncos one? Either one.
Yeah. Jake
Plummer.
Well, I mean, yes. But I would go to the entire Peyton Manning era.
Yeah.
Easily.
Oh my God, yes.
Especially 2015,
yeah.
Which you could really feel was the end of the road for Peyton. And it was like, wow, we were gifted one of the best gifts in sports history. Peyton Manning showed up on our doorstep and we're going to fumble the bag.
Right.
And I felt that so deeply. And it's why that's the most joyless championship in Denver sports history.
Oh, it's because so
the
true,
mortality
dude.
Of the era was so present. You felt it slipping through our fingers. Oh my God, we're going to fumble the bag with Peyton Manning. And
this is the most joyless championship as it could have possibly
because
been.
Everything that went wrong, it felt like, oh, this is the end. This is the end. Right. Oh, they can't score. They're done. They need, you know, honestly, every time they win, it's because they got lucky off a bounce with a turnover.
Even when he got left, though, and was it Osweiler that took over? Even when he came back, that game alone carried a little bit of pressure because it was like they were winning with Osweiler, right? Like they had kind of gotten a rhythm.
You're right. They're 5-2. great credit to Gary Kubiak, who did an incredible coaching job with that team, managing Peyton, managing Brock, managing the team.
Mm-hmm.
He knew it. He just felt it. He was like, this is the moment. Peyton's ready. He's got to go back out there. And it's one of the best clips that maybe is underrated. It's just Peyton comes into the huddle and the whole entire offensive line just starts going, Peyton fucking Manning. And they're kind of like echoing each other one after another. And he's just like, let's go get this shit. They go, they win, they get the one seed, which is crazy for, again, a joyless season. They got the one seed.
Thanks, New England.
They
talk about fumbling the bag.
Fumbled the bag big time. you know, they go and win it. But the pressure, I think, was really heavy. And you want to talk about like media pressure? Maybe in terms of Denver sports, that's the most media pressure there's ever been.
Oh, easily, man.
Because
easily.
It was relentless. Even when they were winning, no one was giving them credit for it.
Right. It wasn't fun. Every game was close. It was like the exact opposite of what was it, the 2013 season where they came out and they scored.
Oh, it was nothing but joy.
Seven touchdowns, and they have the shootout in Dallas.
It was the most fun season of football in my entire life.
And then for it to end the way that it did with that, like, ultra beat-up team that had, just an incredible string of injuries and was using street free agents in the freaking Super Bowl.
Yep.
And obviously, like, the Super Bowl went the way that it did, and Seattle earned that and whatever, you know. But
people
it was also, like,
that
was such an incredibly fun year.
It was.
Watch Broncos
my
football.
Favorite football year.
People forget that Derek Wolfe, Von Miller, and Chris Harris Jr. all did not play in that game.
Yeah.
Those are three guys and who, like, you would say are a massive part of winning the Super Bowl 2 years later.
And a broken down champ.
Yep.
Is in that game where you're like, that's our last, like, memory.
Right. Yep.
Like it was just it was the perfect setup for exactly what went down.
We've talked about this offline. We didn't really think of any Rockies ones that meet this. I mean, the Rockies haven't met that pressure a lot. No. They haven't been in the postseason enough, and their World Series run, there was never a fulcrum moment.
The closest that they ever got was game 163, where it was like, can we get Todd to the postseason once?
Right.
Can we please just let this guy, can we not have this conversation of who's the best player to never play in a playoff game? Right. There was a lot happening. That was a really good team, but there was big, like, do it for Todd energy. And then, you know, obviously everything else that happened, like the iconic moment of that run is there's a bobblehead around here somewhere of it.
After
celebrating catching the last out in the sweep of the Diamondbacks
to
go to the World Series. They never faced any pressure because it was just a free ride. It was Rocktober.
And everyone was like, wow, this is incredible. Yeah. Like,
this is the most fun baseball has ever been.
I will say a little bit of pressure, but all of these stories we've talked about essentially have been about overcoming pressure. The Rockies, not that long ago, played a one-off game for the NL West championship, something they've never gotten before. Yeah.
Would have been really cool.
Would have been really cool if they got it. But I still don't even feel like there was that much pressure on them. And I think it's because
not really.
Yeah. I think it's because they've just never... No one's ever expected anything of the Rockies.
Exactly.
And so they can't really have pressure.
Do you think there's a correlation? We'll get out on this. Pressure... There are cities where the pressure is immense. New York, Philadelphia. You know, there are places where people, the Cowboys, the fan base and the media contingent puts pressure on. You mentioned it's the Nuggets. Nobody really cares. Yeah. You met Rockies. Nobody's really putting pressure. Do you think that feeds into it at all, that there's not loud enough voices putting pressure on the org?
So I think that with the Rockies, the answer is yes. And I think it's because they are the fourth team in town. Now, this is a great baseball town if they give them something to root for. Yeah. You know, like, the sports in this town are essentially come from baseball. But it's, I don't think that anything is expected of them. And usually when the pressure is on, it's really light. I think the Nuggets are a little different. I think that they've become actually, in my opinion, the team of, like, the newest version of Denver. Like, people care about the Nuggets a lot, I think, now. And so I think they're facing pressure because they have greatness on their team. But the Avs and Broncos unquestionably have faced more pressure, with the Broncos obviously being the one that faces the most. But I think because they set expectations to a certain point, after that, everyone expects that of you forever. And I think that has forced them to make moves and be aggressive in trying to continue to be great.
Well, and I also think that, you know, when you have certain talent level of players on your team, comes certain expectations of results, which is where the Nuggets are for the first time ever. You're looking at they have a bona fide, true blue, legitimate MVP top five dude in the NBA. And there's no sport where individual players swing the balance between winning and losing more than in basketball. And so when you have that, and especially when he's a unicorn the way that he is, it creates its own unique kind of pressure that I do think the Nuggets as a franchise are feeling for the first time ever.
The one thing I'll say about that, and this will be the last point for the show here, but basketball, and it's all sports in general, actually even football, but basketball, to me, the players seem the most disconnected from their fan base and from their city. Mm. And I just wonder how much, like, back in the day, I talked to Alex English, he's been on the show, Fat Lever. They talk about Denver as if it was like, that was us and Denver. Like, we were doing that together. I was playing, they were cheering, there we were. And players today, I think, are so disconnected that they don't feel that way. So this sucks. Idea of the city, it does suck, but this idea of the city putting pressure, they commute to work, man. They commute to work for 6 months, and then they commute home. And I just think that's a weird interaction that all sports, even football, has this, I think, more than what it used to be. The Broncos used to be the center of Denver.
Yeah.
Now they're a big part of it still, but I just think players are a little different.
I feel like Jokic specifically cares about the Nuggets in Denver.
God, I hope so.
I think he does.
Well, and what made the Avs thing special is that you have a couple of guys. You know, and Eric Johnson.
Yeah.
He's from Minnesota, which is the worst place in the world.
Yeah,
and, you know, he's from there. He gets traded here. And he makes it his home. Like, he loves Denver. He loves being an Av. And you feel that when you support a team. You can tell who's being real about their genuine love of being part of that organization. There's no lying about that. And I think that was part of what made last year special for us, is that there were people, you know, when the Avs were down bad, Gabe Landeskog goes to Joe Sakic and says, please don't trade me.
Right.
I know that you could get whatever you want in return to try and build for the future, but I want to fix it. I want to fix it here. I want to be the next captain of the Stanley Cup champion Avalanche. And he was.
Guys, that does it for this week's edition of the Denver Sports Podcast. Great stuff today, guys. This was a fun one. It was a fun topic. Lots of good stuff. Coming up, the Susie Show for the number one best team in all of baseball, Colorado Rockies, undefeated. Coming up right next. Hit that.